I'm going to review a little more than I would have normally. Part two of Esther, but last week we were introduced to a young woman called Hadassah. Her Persian name was Esther. She was destined by God for a very critical role. It's now about 480 B.C., and a new king reigns over the Medo-Persian Empire. Some 76 years earlier, Cyrus the Great had conquered Babylon and told all the Jews that were living there, if they wanted to, they could go home. He even says in Ezra 1 that he was appointed by God to do that very thing, and that God had given him all the power he had. He knew exactly who had allowed him to win these victories. In fact, in Isaiah, it says he's going to open the gates and take the bars down everywhere he went. God would go before him. And so I think Cyrus knew that. And somehow he knew that these Jews that had been captive there all these years needed to go home, or they should be allowed to go home. So he told them they could. And you would think that they'd all want to go home. But, of course, some had been there their whole lives. They had been born there. They had no affinity back toward Judah or Jerusalem. They'd never worshipped in the old temple. And the people that had were very old. And they might want to go back. They might have. But who would want to give up everything you had, quit your job, sell your home, lose your business, as we talked about, leave the Medo-Persian school district, and go across a barren desert full of bandits to a place that's in ruins, and you've got no place to live there, no business there, and there are people there that hate you and would like to kill you too. So it wasn't a very appealing thing, so probably just as many or more Jews decided to stay where they were. And unfortunately, they had become comfortable in the Medo-Persian culture. It had had its effect on them, just as our culture has its effect on us. And we're going to see, as we go through this, a little examples of where the culture affected them. For example, when Esther is given the food in the harem, she apparently eats whatever is given to her, especially the good stuff. How did Daniel react to that when they offered him that kind of food? He wouldn't take it because he had some standards of stuff he wouldn't eat. Apparently, she didn't have any of those standards. A little later, we're going to see Mordecai. He never mentions prayer at all. He talks about things that she's got to do and things they ought to do and fasting, but he never mentions prayer. In fact, he never mentions God, at least not in the account here. Yet we know that he knows God is going to have to intercede or they won't make it. It's been interesting how the culture affects us. It's subtle. For example, you may be watching a television program that has some nudity in it and homosexual encounters, but it's really popular. And in next day's Bible study, it's going to be one of the hot topics everybody's going to want to talk about. And if you haven't watched it, you're going to be out of the loop. So, and it's intriguing, it's titillating, and you like kind of want to look forward to the next episode. Satan just kind of likes us to get comfortable in the culture, and these Jews had gotten comfortable in theirs. Well, what does Paul and Peter both say about that? You're a chosen race, this is Peter talking, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. I urge you, as aliens and strangers, to abstain from fleshly lusts, which wage war against the soul. And then Paul, don't be conformed to this world. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good, acceptable, and perfect. Esther's family was among those that decided to stay. And I guess not too long after that, when she was probably a very young girl, both parents died. And her older cousin Mordecai, her uncle's son, decided to raise her as his own daughter, and he does. And the current king, Ahasuerus, reigns over the most powerful empire of the time, 127 provinces, of which Judah is one, which is going to come into play a little later. And to plan an upcoming campaign against Greece, because he'd lost two earlier battles, he invites all his officials to come to Susa, the capital, for a big, long, six-month celebration of his jubilee of 3 or 4 years in power. And also there, I'm sure during the day, they're doing a lot of planning about where they're going to get their troops and how they'll be provisioned and how they're going to attack Greece. But he holds this 6 months celebration. And the last week is really something because he holds a feast for everybody in the town. Every person in the city of Susa, which must have been a rather large city, was invited for 7 days or nights to come to the banquet, to eat everything they wanted. There was plenty of food for everybody, plenty of wine. There was no pressure to drink very much or not drink. You could do what you wanted to, but it cost a fortune. And, of course, part of his reasoning was in order to prove to the people that he was a very benevolent, good ruler, that he had their hearts, their welfare at heart. He wanted the best for them. He was honest. It didn't matter who you were, poor or rich, you would be treated fairly. And that, too, will come into play later in the story. That's the image he wants to portray. And the last night of the whole thing, everybody's about to go home tomorrow, and he realizes there's a treasure they haven't yet seen. It's the queen, Vashti. So he's feeling no pain. He's had several wineskins now by this time and even had to go to the bathroom a couple of times. And so he's feeling pretty good, and he says, why don't we just have her come and let them see her in all her glory? So he sends word for her to show up, and the Hebrew wording can well be translated that she was to show up wearing only her crown, nothing else. Well, that didn't go well with Vashti. She's had a few wineskins herself. She's feeling a little bit strong. And even if he didn't ask her to come nude, she felt like she was being paraded like a show horse for all these drunken rabble, and she didn't want to do that. And if he was asking her to come nude, then he's treating her like a stripper, and she really detests that. So she doesn't go. And maybe she thinks he must be pretty confident of how she stands with him, because she feels, well, when she didn't show up, he'll think it over what he asked, and he'll realize it was really not right, and it won't matter. He'll get over it. He'll let it go. But he isn't thinking rationally. She has embarrassed him before all these important VIPs from all over the kingdom, and he looks like a jerk in their mind, in their eyes, and he immediately says, boy, this is bad news, and his counselors agree with him. If this isn't punished, this disease that she has just exhibited is going to spread through the whole kingdom, and before long there won't be a wife anywhere who will fix a meal for her husband or rub his feet when he comes home from a long day at the feast of the king, and nothing will happen that should happen. And there'll be all kinds of now chapters forming everywhere, and so they can't have that. Well, he banishes her. He sends an edict out that night, signs it, sends it out, or I guess the next day, but it sends it out anyway, to all the princes of the provinces, and she is banished to somewhere way away from Susa. He'll never see her again. She forfeits her crown, and now he's moping around because he sobers up the next day and feels really bad about it. He thinks it was a knee-jerk reaction, really stupid way to react. I shouldn't have done that. I should never make those kind of decisions when I'm a little tipsy. And I was listening to those guys. They were just, it was bad news, bad counsel, bad decision. And he's moping around, and everybody realizes that's not good when he mopes, because he might lash out at you if you're the wine bearer, and that could be bad too. So they kind of come up with something that'll cheer him up. So they come up with a plan whereby the Department of Interior will search out all the really good-looking virgins in the land, and they'll come to Susa. They'll have a year of beauty, social graces makeover, and then each one will spend one night with the king, and whoever pleases him the most will take Vashti's crown. And the king thinks that's a pretty good idea, and Esther is selected because Scripture says she's really good looking. She's beautiful. She has a good figure. She obviously is very easygoing and sure of herself. In fact, she's confident enough to where people take a liking to her immediately. And when she's in the harem, the main eunuch really likes her a lot, gets her the best food, best oils, gives her 7 of the best servants. She always gets the best material for her gowns. So she's beautiful when she finally has time to go to, when her time comes after the year. And of course, she wins the contest because, as we all know, the contest was fixed. That wasn't a fair contest. She was going to win all along because God was orchestrating this whole thing. He wants his handmaiden to be queen of Medo-Persia instead of Vashti when a crisis arises that's going to need her to intercede on behalf of his people. So that brings us now to where we are tonight. And it begins with chapter 2, verses 21 through 23. This is while Esther is in her year of waiting. Mordecai is at the king's gate. Apparently he has gained some kind of a little minor governmental official job, and he's there, but the business is conducted at the king's gate, and he's there every day, but he's also there because he's worried about her. There's a bad downside to this contest. If she doesn't win it, she goes to a second harem and can never, ever leave it. She'll be in there the rest of her life. Can't marry or have children. So he's kind of concerned about her and wants to know how she's getting along. And in this place where he is, he gets to know a lot of the palace officials. And then this happens. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now, when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of Chronicles in the king's presence. That's only a three-verse summary of what went on. Now, when you look a little deeper into that, the Hebrew word for gallows there can be translated post. And the preferred method of execution in those days, in that culture, was not to be hanged. It was to be impaled on a post. Very gruesome. But it was a deterrent. I mean, boy, you knowing that could happen to you, you would watch your step. And anyway, that's what happens to these two guys. There's no long wait on death row. They get what's coming to them. And Scripture is very careful to tell us that everything about it is recorded, including what is recorded? That it was Mordecai that did it. Now, interestingly enough, at this point, Mordecai is not rewarded. Now, if he had been rewarded right here, the whole story would have taken a whole different twist. It would have gone a whole different direction. But he's not rewarded. So there's a bureaucratic oversight, and they just don't reward him. So we'll find out later how important that is. But, you know, it's interesting. Since God decided that, or made it, or orchestrated this such that Mordecai was not rewarded, would it be possible that in your life something has happened to you where you deserved recognition, but you didn't get it? Somebody else got the promotion that you deserved, or somebody else got the